Tees podcast in association with Lo-Fi Arts.
This episode of the podcast is about the hugely influential musician Robert Wyatt. Back in November 2014, I went to Manchester for the Louder Than Words Literary Festival, where in front of an audience I interviewed Marcus O'Dare, who's the author of Wyatt's authorised biography, Different Every Time, which had just come out on Serpent's Tale. After the public interview, we then did another interview in a hotel suite, which I broadcast on my Midnight Campfire radio show. So what I've done is taken out all the music interludes in that interview and cut it together as one piece, which I'm going to play now. Why Robert Wyatt, and how did you first get involved?
I started to write about Robert because two things about him. One is loving the music, and two, him being such an interesting person, you know, with aspects of Marxism and paraplegia and alcoholism and pataphysics and all of these sort of non-musical aspects as well. And then I suppose the extra factor was knowing that no one had done a biography before. So that made it really, really appealing. He's nearly 70. No one's told this remarkable story.
Had you met him?
I met him when I was presenting a monthly podcast for the Independent newspaper. And I went up and interviewed him when he released the box set in 2008. Had a great time interviewing him. And then after that realised that, you know, as I said, no one had written this book. The process then was that I asked him later if he'd mind if I had a go at writing a biography. He was okay with it. And then I, you know, went and wrote a sample chapter and got an agent and, you know, found a publisher, which is Serpent's Tale. And then interviewed Robert a lot, interviewed 75 other people, including people like Bjork and Paul Weller and David Gilmour and Brian Eno and Julie Christie. And then went and tried to turn it all into the story of a life. Presented it to Robert when I'd finished, which is why it's an authorised biography. And, yeah, it was great to see it out now and a book instead of files on my laptop, which is how it was for years.
It's a huge project as well, I should say. It, like, took several years of your life.
Took several years, absolutely. Partially because, although he has a reputation for not doing that much, actually he's done quite a lot. If you throw in Soft Machine and Matching Mole, and all the solo albums, and a huge number of guest appearances and collaborative projects. And the other reason it took a long time is because, as I say, I spoke to a lot of people, and also because I was doing lots of other things. You know, I work in a university, I have a band called Grasscut, who've actually worked with Robert, and, you know, working as a journalist and broadcaster, so there were periods when I wouldn't work on the book for months on end, and then suddenly I'd get a bit of time to try and move it on a few hundred words.
The story is also of Alfie, his partner, who's a really huge part of Robert's life, and they've had this enormous lifelong sort of partnership. Was she a big part of the process of getting the gig as well? And what was it like getting to know them as a couple?
Yeah, Alfie, Alfreda Benge, is, as you say, an enormous part of this. They got married on the same day that Rock Bottom, probably Robert's most famous album, was released. And that's 40 years ago. So they've been married 40 years, that means. And yes, I mean, she's hugely important creatively. She has done all his album covers since 1974, which are absolutely superb. She also has co-written lyrics since Don the Stein in 1991, or written some lyrics, I should say. The other reason she's important is that she's his manager, which she sort of became by accident. She doesn't have any history of managing people. But in a way, all you need to be a good manager is, you know, to have the artist's interests genuinely at heart, and also be prepared to say no sometimes to things, and then the artist can use you to as a sort of gatekeeper. And that did mean that both of them were very open to me doing the book, but more than having to convince Robert, I did feel like I had to convince her. You know, she has that sort of gatekeeper role, and she's brilliant at it. You know, that's a big part, I think, of though it's kind of a behind-the-scenes role. Some people don't know. It's fundamental to his... he's only a cult success, I suppose, but he's like a big cult artist, isn't he? And she's fundamental in that.
A major sort of influential, long-term, whatever. Yeah, so she is the...
she is the person who's able to say no when perhaps he says yes all the time.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So he's really well known as a kind of a Marxist or a very hard left. I mean, he was a member of the Communist Party in the early 80s. Perhaps his most famous mainstream moment is Shipbuilding, which, of course, he didn't write. It was Elvis Costello and...
And Clive Langer, who's a producer. Basically, Clive Langer wrote the chords and the melody, and Elvis Costello wrote the lyrics for Shipbuilding. Political, although there was a prominent left movement in opposition to Thatcher, it wasn't necessarily the Communist Party at that stage, ironically, which was being divided between a new element, which Robert says is what turned into New Labour, sort of Marxism Today lot, and then he was more associated with a kind of old school, slightly more Soviet associated kind of communism, which was associated with a different publication called the Morning Star. And you know, they're the sort of lefties who get condemned as tankies and Stalinists and all of this. If you read the old copies of the NME, it's all kind of him sometimes getting slammed for being the wrong sort of lefty. And yet, you know, his politics is really personal. He sent me an email just the other day which said, people say the personal is political, obviously a big sort of feminist mantra. He said, I've realised that for me, the political is personal, which is really interesting. And his politics is very grassroots. It's about individuals. It's not, and nowadays he doesn't say that there's an ist or an ism that he adheres to, but he sees the world through a Marxist perspective, where he's looking at, you know, power balances and economics and that as underpinnings of what's happening in any area, including culture.
I love the phrase you use in a magazine interview, which is yours, not his, I think, where you said that he found Marxism the most useful lens through which to see the world, which is actually a very gentle way of describing it, even though it's steadfast. And so you would still say he is kind of radical lefty today.
Yeah, well, in a way, it's quite gentle, his politics, even though it's hardline, and especially if you read the interviews in the 80s, when he was actually a card-carrying communist, he can sound more hardcore. And he's working with, you know, as you mentioned, Elvis Costello, also people like Jerry Dammers, one of the other artists who's managed to make political tunes that are brilliant politically, but also brilliant musically,
like,
which
hits, proper,
so smash, rare, yeah. You know. Robert worked with him around the same time, and in interviews around that time, he's kind of saying artists must engage with politics, you can't not. Nowadays, he's a bit less sort of didactic about it, and he just says you can do whatever you want. But for me, it's often the politics that basically gives the song the meaning, and it gives me the inspiration to do it. It's just, this is how I see things. He had this idea in the 1980s that he would make unmisusable music, where he would put lines in that meant that his political opponents couldn't possibly like the music because there'd be a reference to Chomsky or something.
Yes, he's kind of almost trying to shed any fans that are of the wrong...
Yes.
Colour.
Yeah, and he doesn't feel like that anymore. You know, he said there's loads of people who like my music whose politics I probably don't like, and I think he's probably mellowed a bit.
So, yeah,
about
it's kind
that.
Of mellowing with age, but not...
But not shifting to the right. And
no.
That's the unusual thing, because there's so many former radical lefties who end up becoming slowly more conservative.
Yeah, become centre-left and then centrist and so on.
Yeah, and he hasn't done that rightward shuffle.
Robert Wyatt had this other great philosophical interest, which was Alfred Jarry's absurdist pataphysics idea. Now, it's tough to explain. It's a bit like Mornington Crescent. It's a kind of game. But can you give it a go? Can you explain what on earth pataphysics is?
Pataphysics was invented by someone called Alfred Jarry, as you say, in kind of Belle Epoque Paris. It's a little... It's a precursor to surrealism, Dadaism, theatre of the absurd, people like Beckett. Picasso was a fan of pataphysics. The Marx brothers were fans. People like J.G. Ballard are fans as well. And also, you know, other musicians, but Soft Machine, Robert's first band, were inspired by pataphysics. And I suppose... And he says he's still inspired by its teachings today. And it's kind of, as you'd expect by something that's kind of linked to surrealism, it's kind of playful and not serious, but in a way that humour is incredibly serious, because the whole point of pataphysics is defined by Jenner as a science of imaginary solutions. So it is kind of playful, impossible to pin down, you know, extremely elusive, but it's something to do with the absurdity of existence, I suppose. And it links to Robert's interest in people like Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear and Hilaire Belloc, were kind of proto-surrealist kind of people, a sort of surrealism that isn't all about drooping clocks and Salvador Dali, not that he anything against that, but it's a sort of... Jarry is French, Hilaire Belloc and Edward Lear English, but there's a sort of, it's that sort of surrealism that is desperately sincere in a way, but is also poking fun and playful.
Well, that kind of content is less vain as well in many ways.
How do you mean?
That someone like Dali does want to be taken seriously and would think worse of you if you didn't, whereas maybe the pataphysicists would... want to be taken seriously so that they could laugh at you that you took them seriously.
Yeah,
so exactly. They'll almost respect you more if you join in the fun.
Yes. It's something to do with modernism as well, the interest in pataphysics. It's something to do with... Robert often says this thing that people were expected to hate the art of their parents' generation, and he didn't feel that. He loved Paul Klee and Matisse and Picasso and, you know, the visual art of his parents' era, and he liked... especially as he gets older, even more so. He likes jazz. You know, he was associated with jazz rock in the 60s and early 70s. But increasingly as he gets older, and having grown up in that brilliant... you know, he would have come of age in that brilliant year for jazz, 1959, where you had Miles and Mingus and Coltrane and Brubeck and Ornette Coleman. And that was sort of avant-garde era of jazz. But as he gets older, and even when he was young, he was also interested in Ellington and, you know, much earlier eras of jazz... I think you can link his interest in pataphysics to interest of arts from in the arts of sort of 100 years ago more.
When we had our conversation in front of an audience a bit earlier on, you said a brilliant thing about jazz and rock, that because Wyatt exists on the cusp of jazz and rock and often might get merged with the people who do fusion, but you said that pataphysics is about turning things upside down. Often it's about... reordering processes for this kind of absurdist outcome. And then you said that his approach to jazz and rock crossing over was the upside down version of... I can't remember what you said, but
Well, it's Robert's quote, which, if I can remember, is basically that definitely when he didn't get on with Soft Machine in this era when they were going very jazz rock and they couldn't understand. There's quotes from the others saying, but he liked jazz and he liked rock. Why didn't he like this? And you know, they were playing. They did a show with Miles Davis, say, in the kind of fusion era. But what Robert says is jazz rock was the wrong way around, as you say. And what it was is kind of tended to get codified and set as a rock rhythm section with jazz solos on top that lasted, you know, 20 minutes.
So noodling on top of a rock
on
beat.
Top of a very sturdy, macho kind of a beat. And what he says is it should be, for him at least, you know, the other way around, which is a light, fluid, jazzy rhythm section underpinning songs of actually a rock or even folk kind of simplicity. So he cites something like Astral Weeks, Van Morrison's album, as being an example of that, which is much more song-based. But there's loads of jazz players on it. It's much more song-based.
And it does have that beautiful, fluid, amazing sort of sound to it that's turned it into a classic album.
Yeah, and it's something, therefore, is not about showing off your chops as a soloist, even though Robert loves jazz.
So Robert Wyatt lived quite hard, partied quite hard. He wasn't into drugs, but he drank a lot, and he was hanging out with Keith Moon, toured the States with Jimi Hendrix, did a lot of kind of abandonment of his body in a kind of rock and roll way as a young guy. And then in 1973... he fell out of a window at a party at a flat in London and was near death and almost died, and then was a paraplegic for life and was confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And you asked him about that time. Was it difficult to ask him?
Well, I suppose it's the sort of thing which you don't ask the first question, and, you know, you sort of build up to it. And I spent several days interviewing him for it, so... I probably waited a while, but he's okay with talking about it, and he has spoken about it, and you certainly couldn't write the story of his life without it. He always downplays the only difficulty in a way is he didn't want to talk about the exact circumstances of the fall. In fact, he said to me that he can't remember them. He was too drunk. And so I researched what he said at other times a bit, and that's the version I presented to him, and he was okay with it. He's open to talking about the drinking at the party before the fall, and also about things like landing on the pavement just after from a fourth floor you know, window and the experience in hospital. And it's interesting, his album Rock Bottom that came out the year after The Fall, some of it was worked out on the piano in the Stoke Mandeville visitor's room where he found a piano. And it was The Fall, which he says, he looks on it quite positively, because it forced his hand into being a solo artist, having been previously a collaborative musician, because he couldn't carry on. He was a sort of singing drummer, what he calls a drummer biped, and he couldn't carry on being that. And so he became primarily a singer from then on and a solo artist.
Another a really intense part of his life, and I found a really dramatic part of the book towards the end, because I wasn't expecting it, maybe, because it's quite recent in his life, is that in his 60s, as recently as 2007, his drinking became a proper problem, and at that point he had to quit, and he was challenged to. So basically Alfie said, gave him an ultimatum and said, quit drinking or I'll leave you. And again, that's another subject that you've covered really well in the book, but must have been quite a sort of either a revelation that they told you weren't expecting, or something that was difficult to ask about if you'd found out about it from other sources.
In a way, I'm lucky that they are quite open to talking about, unusually open to talking about that kind of thing. You know, Alfie said, I gave him an ultimatum, and I said, are you okay with me putting that in? And she's, yeah, fine. You know, no, that's what happened, so that's, you know, that's not a secret. And I suppose they have an attitude where that kind of thing comes through into the songs. So there's a song from an album that came out around that time called Just As You Are, which is exactly about that look in your eye, I can see you despise me, and so on. And it's about drinking and deception, and, you know, sort of, they're not trying to brush it under the carpet. They've sort of written a song about it and released it, so it'd be hard to deny, I suppose. They were fine with talking about it, and, you know, I came along just when he sobered up, really. It took about a year in 2008, was the first time I interviewed him, and started the book a little while after that. And, you know, he's been sober throughout, still smoking a cigarette, but not drinking.
There's a whole nuance of that, because Alfie contributes to some of the lyrics, or is a lyricist and writes lyrics to whole songs. So there must be moments where she's writing a lyric that must have some reference to him that he's then singing.
Yes, that's an interesting point, and I probably should have asked them that. You know, the tensions between the lyrics Alfie writes and the music you set is quite interesting. I know that, say, on, what's that, Catholic Architecture, which actually is something that Grasscut, my band, covered. I've heard Alfie...
We've played it on the programme.
OK, brilliant, yes. Good man. I've heard Alfie saying that... the last line of that song is, in lovingly lacerated hands. And I've heard Alfie say, "What, Robert, you shouldn't have said it to such a nice melody, that's supposed to be more of a barbed line," or something, you know, that kind of thing.
So he's sweetened her lyrics.
Which is interesting. Or I know also more recently than that, a song about the war in the Middle East, because, you know, politics still informs some of the material, quite obviously. There's a line Alfie put in, which is from the perspective of a civilian whose house has been bombed. And the line is, "You've plastered all your everlasting hatred in my heart." Robert was saying that the engineer was surprised that to hear him sing a line like a word like hatred, which seems very strong, but he just said, "That's my Alfie, she tells it like it is." You know, that's how you'd feel if someone had just bombed your house.
Yeah, that's really harsh. And then famously, this beautiful voice. So, yeah, it does feel funny. You interviewed a huge number of people for this book. Any particular favourites? I mean, you interviewed Brian Eno and Julie Christie. So you've got across a whole swathe of culture, and a sort of cross-generational as well. So anyone you particularly enjoyed?
My favourites were, I'm very grateful to a huge number of people for talking to me, and everyone was very, very willing on the basis that they liked Robert. But I suppose my favourite two were probably Brian Eno and Chris Cutler, who was the drummer in a band, Henry Cowell, which Robert worked with them in the 70s. Both, you know, from quite different musical backgrounds, and yet hugely insightful, very intelligent people, and also very useful because they've known Robert over decades. And, you know, that perspective is really, really useful as well. So those two were probably the two that come to mind first.
And alongside the book is called Different Every Time, and it's out on Serpent's Tail. And you've worked with Domino Records to produce this compilation album, kind of the definitive history of Robert Wyatt. And it's two discs. One is a kind of a hits collection, kind of a best of, but a quirky best of, and a sort of thoughtful career retrospective, but the kind of big hitters. And the other is his collaborations, and the collaborations have been a huge part of his career, and she sort of had some involvement in that as well.
Yeah, it's quite weird how the tracks got agreed. It was a sort of collaborative process between me a guy called Andy Childs, who's a brilliant industry figure. He used to be Robert's A&R at one stage, and also a brilliant writer. And Robert and Alfie themselves, with some input from Domino as well, of course. And so we sort of balanced track ideas between us. And one of the things that's interesting is Robert's level of involvement in it, because sometimes people, often he deliberately leaves his tracks sounding a bit scruffy and people think he's slapdash. One of the things I think is fascinating is how carefully calibrated that apparent slapdash element is. And it was evident even in the compiling the compilation. Robert put so much into it in terms of things like sequencing the tracks, the gap that should be left between the tracks, which, you know, as a musician, you know, is the sort of thing that probably people don't think about, but is really, really important to how the record comes across. Things like that, Robert was really, really interested in getting exactly right. So he really cares, and it was very evident working on the compilation. And the compilation, as you say, I mean, one of them is a best of, which there are other compilations out there, so in a way you're trying to find a version of things that's different to the versions that are already out there. This one's different in that it's got a Soft Machine track and a couple of Matching Mole tracks, as well as the solo stuff. So that's quite unusual to have that spread of material. And the collaborations one, both of these are available as a double CD together, or you can buy the individual vinyl, because each of them is a double vinyl. So you can just buy one or the other on vinyl. The compilations one has got all sorts of brilliant stuff. Robert working with Bjork, Hot Chip, more obscure people as well, and old people like Mike Mantler, who's a great Austrian trumpet player, did this kind of mad, epic jazz operas on ECM records and stuff. So huge spreads of different music. And that might be the one, if one of the vinyls is an sort of intro to Robert, an idiosyncratic best of, this is one that even some fans have said to me, oh, I didn't know Robert did that, because those tracks were not released under Robert's name. They were released, obviously, their guest appearances, and they were released under the names of the artist.
He's an incredibly difficult artist to be a completist of.
Yes.
Because you can be a really dyed-in-the-wool passionate fan, but he will go off and play with some very obscure somewhere, and also somewhere else in the world, and perform or like contribute to a music, and also not necessarily his vocals, although this particular compilation concentrates on his singing, but the ones where he's maybe just gone and played a bit of piano or done some drumming, and then it will be released on some obscure label somewhere and no one's going to tell you. So he is a treasure trove.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, even on something like the sample of his drumming on the, you know, when Brian Eno and David Byrne reprised the My Life in the Bush of Ghosts album a few years ago, a bit of his drumming shows up on that or something, where there's just loads of, like, how did you get there? And there's loads and loads of examples of that. Even yesterday, he sent me a link to a SoundCloud page, which is him playing Ten Horn for the first time ever with a collaboration. And luckily, he sent it to me, but I would never have... You have to be real obsessive to have spotted that.
Finally, so yeah, you spent a lot of time involved in this project. You got to know the Wyatts really well. So do you kind of miss them now you've moved on as a subject?
It is funny. So I read, or someone said to me, or I read while I was writing it, that biographies go wrong when you fall out of love with the subject. And, you know, I hope that it's not a hagiography. Robert said some of it's quite uncomfortable reading for him.
I would definitely say it isn't. I think you have done a very good job of being warm initially. Your starting position is very sympathetic, and you want to tell this story of someone that you obviously admire, but you have not pulled your punches as a journalist. I think you were, you know, your journalist instincts are in there, I definitely think.
Thanks, I hope so. And I think that, I mean, Robert didn't give me any advice about what kind of book he wanted, but I imagine that he wouldn't want a book that's 100% positive either, you know. But anyway, what I was going to say is I didn't fall out of love with the subject. For all, you know, hopefully it's a sort of relatively warts and all portrait, but I still find him equally inspiring, more in some ways. And I certainly learned a huge amount myself in doing it. I don't exactly miss it, because the actual period of doing the interviews was ages ago. It took me a long time to turn all the interviews into the book, but I did all the interviews at the start of it. So the time of hanging out with Robert and Alfie and the other people was ages ago on the whole. So I've got used to that not being around. And now I just need to work out what the hell to do next.
But during working on this book, your life changed loads. You became a dad. You became a sort of life. You settled down in a way. And you became an academic, which, you know, you started on a new road as
Yes, that's true. I mean,
you had a stroke.
Plus I had a stroke, got married. Yeah, that's true.
You're the most unlikely looking person I've ever known to have a stroke. Not that I would prejudge people who have strokes, but you're like very young. You're like, you don't, you're not overweight. You're like you know, it was really slightly scary that you would have had a stroke.
Well, yeah, I had a stroke after just after my daughter was born. I hit my head, not even that hard, on a shelf while I was carrying her. Just kind of clipped it. And then had a massive headache. And didn't actually have the stroke for 2 weeks. Went to 4 doctors and they said, oh, you've just got a headache, don't worry about it. And then had a stroke after that. And apparently that's quite common because it's a blood clot that takes a while to sort of loose itself. And it's when it starts floating around that you're in trouble.
I'm cringing. You say,
oh, yeah, what's your next? But anyway, I mean, that was one of the things that happened to me on the way. I think I'm okay now. It didn't hold it up that much. But things like that, yes, I suppose, because it took me, you know, a few years to do, I suppose I am in a slightly different position in various ways now from when I started it. It's funny, yes, married with a kid and another one on the way, and working in the university from having begun it as a freelance journalist.
Yeah, yeah. You were precariat, and now yes. You're established.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So in a way...
What's happened?
In theory, Wyatt should loathe you now when he liked you before.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you know what you're going to work on next?
No, not exactly. I've been really enjoying, actually, because it's now out, writing some associated articles. So it's been a chance to revisit Robert from various different perspectives. So suddenly it'll be, you know, focusing on Robert and jazz, or Robert and pataphysics, or Robert as a collaborator, or these kind of, even on Alfie's role. So I've really enjoyed just writing a handful of articles around that. Written, you know, the thing I've just finished this weekend is an academic chapter on Finnish jazz.
Wow.
So just writing some different things.
We're massive fans of Grasscut on this programme, and I've played Beacon and Catholic Architecture quite a few times and stuff off Unearth, and you are one of the bands that I get the biggest response for, and definitely people in my listenership love that. So thank you very much for spending the time with me, and it's been really nice to hang out, and thank you very much for doing this whole Robert Wyatt thing with me as well. It's been really great.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. I mean, you know, I used to do shows on Juice myself, feel hugely well disposed towards it, and, you know, much enjoyed having a chat.
Great, nice one.
Chris TT's podcast in association with Lo-Fi Arts.